transition to our Blue Book panel discussion portion of our reunion. I'd like to introduce myself again. I'm Major Sam Liberti, and I'll be your untrained moderator for this portion of the Blue Book panel discussions. I kind of look at my role as somewhat of Geraldo Rivera, Oprah Winfrey, Phil Donahue, only with without the looks or the paycheck. Again, on behalf of the commander and staff of the National Air Intelligence Center, I'd like to welcome you to our Blue Book panel discussions. We are indeed honored to have you folks here today, our distinguished civilian and military alumni, with our reunion activities, and especially in light of this 25th anniversary Blue Book anniversary. Is it the 25th anniversary of the closing of Blue Book, or the opening of Blue Book?
Close.
Okay. What we'd like to do is we have what we think is a pretty good show for you today. But in any event, our purpose in bringing together our Blue Book panel discussions is twofold. First, with the anniversary of Project Blue Book and the current media blitz of all the UFO-related news stories, we felt appropriate to, as I like to say, as Paul Harvey says, get the rest of the story from the real experts in the science and technology areas. Unfortunately, most of us may have been weaned on contemporary press and media, which leans toward the existence of extraterrestrial activity. We want to use our time today to exchange stories about your work on the project and talk about any other work experiences which articulate the Intelligence Center's contributions to our national security. Our second purpose is to, well, how can we say, pass on down an oral history of each of your professional experiences to some of our less seasoned military and civilian professionals who now carry the charge for the National Air Intelligence Center. I encourage each of you to offer anecdotes of your Blue Book experiences. Our audience and staff are all very friendly and eager to listen to your story. It's important to note, as far as I know, that all Project Blue Book subjects aren't classified anymore, but I want you to be aware there may be some exceptions if we get into details of intelligence collection or analysis discussions which reveal modern-day activities or capabilities at the Air Intelligence Center. I'd like to point out again, we have no media present today or other folks who will question your point of views or comments or anecdotes. We are, however, as you can see, taping this event for official historical purposes. What we'd like to do now, we've prepared a little video to try to set the stage for our discussions, which some of you may find humorous or thought-provoking, depending on your views. The video lasts about 15 minutes. As a matter of fact, courage that you've all exhibited in the face of such dangerous aliens. So I think you folks are definitely under-recognized for your contributions to national security. I'm curious, though, what we try to present here, obviously, is the whole cut of the pie of the UFO myth dilemma, if you will, all the way from the media perpetuating the event through the so-called experts who have their anecdotes and stories, and then we try to obviously bring levity in it with, as you all, most of you recognize, Colonel Quinn Ellis' response. Nonetheless, the myth keeps getting perpetuated. There's just a wealth of anecdotal evidence, but yet little physical evidence. But we have the great faithful masses who keep moving forward and surging forward, moving the UFO myth on down the street. Well, again, what I want to reiterate is we have a wonderful opportunity here today with our logical and clear-thinking scientific and technical experts that we have in the audience today. What we'd like to do is bring forward a panel of folks who, because of their experience with Project Blue Book and general varied experiences in the scientific and technical fields, they volunteered to serve as our discussion panel experts, if you will. Now that said, I am going to rely on our folks who are going to be up front in front of the stage But I'm also turning to the audience to add your stories and anecdotes and help answer questions or raise questions regarding this entire subject. And with the help of our historical films here and our good Lieutenant McAndrew, who just did the Roswell incident investigation, hopefully we can possibly lay to rest some of these myths and carry forward a clear-thinking logic. I caution you that if we don't do this now, then we doom our future youth and science community to rely more or less on the popular press to get their information about Project Blue Book, because this will all be buried away in historical files. So again, I'd like to encourage you to take this opportunity to speak your mind and help facilitate our discussions. And if you don't, then we'll just go to lunch early. What I'd like to do is welcome our panel members. Again, what I hope is that this somewhat sterile, organized forum turns into more of what I'd like to say is an informal coffee clutch. I encourage you to speak your mind and proceed on. If I may ask, starting with Lucy, if you'd introduce yourself and maybe tell the audience and us exactly some of the things you've done.
I am Lucy Lamore. That's how I assist you. Starting with this outfit in January the 3rd of 1946. Anyhow, what I know about flying saucers or UFOs or unidentified or whatever you call them is it was in the either in the spring or summer of 1947. I worked for the colonel who headed up the analysis division. And he said, well, he called me on Saturday morning. He got me out of bed and said, Lucy, we have some officers here that need to dictate a report. And I said, this is Saturday. And I'm just out of bed. And I don't have a car. He said, I'll hop in the car and ask you. I said, okay, I'll get up. Oh, this thing, but I'll hop in the car and ask you. I said, fine. I get up and I go out to my room base. And there are two officers. Howard. And I sit down and I'm taking dictation. And I thought, this is a joke. It's not April Fool's. Those boys were not drinking much either. And they were angry. But I, I'm just a little girl. What do I know? You know, I'm just taking the patient and I'm looking up and I'm trying to say, I don't know, but I think he's got a good angle. I never heard these things, you know. I think, I know they can see what they say they saw, but who am I? So I and there they go. When they left, I said to Tom, hang on, is this a joke? And they said, no, you see, they really think they saw. And I said, well, if they think they saw it, they must have had a good angle last night, because that is absolutely, it was just absolutely the height. So anyhow, from then on, we've got another sighting. We're just a little about this division. Never heard of UFO or renamed UFO. Unidentified flying object. Anyhow, we were T2 of Air and Gerald Command, and as the sightings begin to come in, not quickly, but periodically, the colonel assigned some officer to be the project officer of this special project that we're going to do. And we set up a little project. And as we got to the lighting, they took them under advisement and got somebody to go out and investigate them. and ended up either they were unidentified or they were celestial or what. Anyhow, it became more, and we moved from Area B to Area A. Now they've got to find an officer to be the special project officer for this outfit, for this special project. And it became known as no, it was not Fleetwood yet.
Recollection of taking dictation I remember we moved from Area B to Area A and took second story of, I think it was 867, building that now is a parking lot. And the analysis division was given the job passed down from Colonel Butt to, in response to General Twain, saying that he wanted this thing to be followed actively. And a Colonel Miles Gold, who was acting chief of analysis, set up a special situation room on that second floor to collect the reports that came in and a few fragments of hardware that were collected. People picked up things that they said fell off of UFOs, or some of them actually were the models that were used in the spurious photography of the UFOs. That situation room was probably 8 feet wide and 10 feet long, with a door on it that had limited access that only a few people got into. Well, I thought I remembered George Gregory in there tacking up some of the early stuff when Colonel Gold took me in and showed me the room. This year when I talked to George and asked him about it, he said he didn't remember that he was involved at that time, but he certainly does remember later. George was I'd like to say a few words about him. He was got out of World War II, a captain. He'd been in the T-38 group snoop outfit of Elliot Roosevelt's reconnaissance in the battlefield, and was somewhat of had a World War career, a World War II career. He worked here as a civilian, then he was recalled during Korea, stayed in the military, went to Vietnam, concluded 110 missions in Vietnam. He's been decorated frequently for efforts in the intelligence field as well as in the reconnaissance in Vietnam. I tried desperately to get George to come, and he's the person who should be sitting here. But unfortunately, he was scheduled to have a hip replacement, rework, an overhaul, if you will, right this day. So he could not be here. But George sent me a box. I wanted to show you the box. Really a surprise. A beautifully arranged box. And in it, when I open it, I've got a 150-page summary of the whole UFO program. George has the implementing directives of the Project Blue Book all the way through. He picked up organization charts, some of the reports that came in that you saw in the movie, which was extraordinarily good. And then, of course, the final closure of the project. This is George's lifetime interest in the UFO effort. And he has, I think, created an outstanding document. I would like to make it available here for any of you seriously interested in what went on. They are all in plastic jackets, so some of these are irreplaceable documents, but you can come up and look them over. I am going to leave them here for a view. It was our intention, I talked to Bruce Ashcroft, that we would pass this on down to the Air University to be in the UFO file. Well, we found out the Air University has sent their whole UFO file to the National Archives. So it is now our intention to pass this on to the National Archives. Greg has deeded them over to me with a legal document, so I have the responsibility for maintaining and then just actually putting them into somebody's hands for permanent retention. I'd also like to mention that George's job, in addition to the UFO, he put together the Intelligence Collection Guidance Manuals for the collection of technical intelligence. And particularly the collection people and the analysis people here from back in the old days. Remember when Greg used to go around from desk to desk and collect the collection highlights of information that we wanted, and he put them together in what became Air Force manual, and he has documented all this and has a record of the whole affair for which he was decorated. He also points out that the center at that time had tried two contracts. And in those days, we spent big money, $50,000, and the contracts failed to do the job, and Greg did them. And he did an outstanding job. And then third and lastly, Greg put together a military sketch of his own career. And I think this too is a astonishingly good document of a guy that went to the trouble to document his own career in a real fine heritage to his children. And all the children do have copies of it. But Greg has articles here on himself and publications, decorations, and so forth. Some of you that knew him well would probably like to browse in that. I also contacted Colonel Nate Rosengarten, who was recalled for active duty to then Attic in 1951. And he was head of, I believe, the Aircraft Division Analysis, or Aircraft Branch of the Analysis Division. And he said he was the one who appointed Captain Ruppel to the requirements for an officer to be the first Blue Book officer. He said he appointed Ruppel because Ruppel was a real fine officer, did whatever he was asked to do in a real good fashion, and knew he would do a good job. Tried to get Rosie to be here to sit on the panel because he actually went out on a couple of the reviews of officers who had seen flying objects, in particular two pilots in the Fort Monmouth area. Saw a flying object while they were flying a training mission. And at the same time that they reported these objects close to them, the Fort Monmouth is an Army electronic center, and the radar operators at Fort Monmouth were tracking the UFOs at that time to corroborate the information. Well, when Rosie sat in on the review with these officers, and then later, I guess, the analysis proved that the whole thing was, as many of them, tracking a weather balloon. It had automatic altitude compensation features in it. As the temperature changed, the balloon changed altitude, and all the evidence seen by the pilots and by the radar were corroborated with the behavior of the balloon. So I think there were a lot of instances like that. Colonel Rosengarten wanted me to be sure and tell you that he thought that the more sightings were reported, fostered even more new ones to come in. Every time you had a good headline item, well, then you'd have a bunch of new ones reported shortly after. Now, my last association with the project was that I sat in on several briefings by a major friend and Lieutenant Colonel Quintanilla. It was usually with Dr. Hynek present. He was our contract consultant on the UFO. He was a professor of astronomy. So we would sit in staff meeting and listen to this, the status and the progress and what they were about to do. And it was almost always a unanimous opinion of the staff. Herman here, IH, remembers real well. Everybody say, why don't we get rid of that project and use the manpower and money for something worthwhile? But we couldn't get out of it because it was a directive from headquarters USAF. Well, another, just recently I was talking to Homer Martin on the telephone, telling him about this meeting, and Homer unfortunately couldn't come because of health problems. It appears that many, many of us aren't coming because of health problems. And I think the long-range projection that Major Liberty spoke of, Bruce spoke of, into the future, what we're going to do next year and the year after, it occurs to me it won't be too many years before they're going to have a different group of people here to listen to it. But nonetheless, Homer said he was given the job one day of going up to the Pentagon, and I guess somebody like Weinbrenner said, Homer, when you're up there, go rap it on the doors from the Pentagon until you find somebody that will get us off this Blue Book project. So Homer went to several staff offices. He said, everybody agreed, let's get out of it. But he said, nobody would take the responsibility of implementing this. Till I finally found some office, albeit PR office for chief of staff or whatever, so the Air Force kind of got out of the business and it became a national science project from there on. Last year when Colonel Quintanilla came up, Bruce and I met with Carl Day, the local TV producer, and talked a little bit about what we could, what we knew and our experience associated with this project. And then I think within a month, Carl Day had Colonel Quintanilla on local TV. And I believe what the picture you saw here of Quintanilla's comments left his expletive on what he thought of the project may have come out of that interview. Quint was not in particularly good health. He had a heart attack while he was here. He unfortunately didn't feel strong enough to come up and be on the panel. Well, that pretty well sums up what I know about it. And again, my apologies for being sitting here with the UFO experts. I picked up a book just a day ago, UFO Encounters. And it's a real classy book with a lot of pictures in it. But on page 32 of the book, I think you can at least see the size of the picture that's dedicated to it. We have General Roger Ramey, who was then the commanding general of the 509th, the only U.S. Atomic Energy Delivery Outfit in the Air Force then, speaking to General John Samford, who was the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, and we have Captain Ed Ruppelt looking over, seeing what Samford is telling Ramey. And then we have the illustrious Roy James sitting to my left, organization. They had all gone up to the Pentagon to discuss what Roy is going to tell you about. But I just want to tell you that we've got at least one very prominent national figure in publication in our group here. That's about all I have to say. I'd be glad to respond to any questions. Bye now.
I'm facing a difficult dilemma. Was there a question?
Yeah, I had one over here. Please.
And a quick one about the material. I'm a member of the Air Force Museum Foundation. I'm curious why that isn't a candidate.
I have contacted them, and they would like to see it.
If you get it in the archives, it disappears for over a year. It might even be available.
I'll tell you more about that.
Question on that.
Yeah. Mr. Billy, no one has mentioned the little green men, and anyone that knows that I've worked at the base are always asking me about it. So I will tell you all about the little green men. When we worked in the old fun center, we had a few parties in the warehouse across the street. German prisoners were kept there during the war. And to amuse themselves, they put murals on the wall. They had the hula hula girls. They had all sorts of things. And they had little green men. And loose lips people went home and mentioned little green men at the base. And that's what I tell people, but nobody believes me.
Our distinguished panel members are telling us very colorful stories, but I also have a list of 20 questions I'd kind of like to throw out to the audience and get to those. If I may be so bold as to try to get some more introductions, and then hopefully we can sneak in a few of these questions that I think would be of value to the historical record. If I might, Roy, would you like to say a few words about where you worked? And then maybe we can get into your background as part of the discussion.
I worked at the electronics division for many years. Getting back to the UFO problem, the most famous UFOs as detected by radar were those that occurred over Washington, D.C. in the hot summer of 1952. At a recent point where FTD or ATIC was called on to send people down to help solve General Sam's problem. When we got there, of course, the UFOs were gone. They were no longer on the radar school. And somebody had told the press to take these scope photos, so there was nothing to be analyzed. But I had had 2.5 years experience with the radar that was used at the airport there, National Airport. And this press conference lasted 1 hour and 20 minutes. And in that 1 hour and 20 minutes, I answered or made statements 45 times. In fact, I felt like I was on the hot seat. I kept looking at General Sanford to see if he thought I was taking over. A couple of times he said, if I may relieve Captain James, and he'd say something, and it would come right back to me on radar detection. When this happened, the intelligence department in Washington sent two officers over to see the scopes. And they reported back to General Sanford that, yes, there were solid UFOs. And that they had surrounded Washington, D.C. Of course, all heck broke loose. My experience with type radar, I was familiar with the weather effects that cause detection of ground targets that are not normally seen. And I postulated over and over that was what was going on. And 1 hour into the press conference, General Sanford more or less agreed with that as an answer to the UFOs that they were seen by temperature inversion effects on radar. I have a piece of a book here by Dr. Donald Menzel. He wrote a book on the world of flying saucers. And in this report, he reports that by dawn, this fantastic war of the angels, radar signals, had ended and the postmortems had begun. One radar expert who kept his head in spite of the hysteria was Captain Roy James of ATIC, who immediately recognized the targets as caused by weather. I did that without ever seeing the targets on the scope. Today, this is the answer.
Gus Simpson, if you'd like to say a few words, please.
Like Vic, I started at STD T2 in 1946. Prior to that, I remember Vic was in the Army Laboratory, I was in the Journal Laboratory, and was talked into joining P2 by a fellow named Charlie Noddle, who was specialty with Rhode Island Red Chicken. In 51, I left P2 and went to Patel. I stayed at Patel, so I retired in 84. During that entire period, FTD supported research at Patel, variously known as Project Stork or Half Stork. And a check I made the day before yesterday, NAIC still supports the research at Patel, which makes it one of the longest standing continuous support projects that Patel has ever had. Now about Blue Box. We are one of the people who actually worked on Blue Box. Did two studies for you all. The first one, we received gobs and gobs and gobs of sightings, and we were tasked by the project officer to evaluate these, and I thought it would be interesting to know what kind of people we used to evaluate these sightings. Some of you, who are as old as I am, remember Dr. David T. Williams, who's a PhD physicist. He left the show rather early in his career and became head of the aeronautical engineering at the University of Florida, Gainesville. He participated completely in all evaluations. Another fellow was Dr. Pete Dalinger, who was a geophysicist. Each of these sites went through, depending on how valid they were, most of them, I hate to tell you, were plain ordinary garbage. But those that had some hard to understand points, and these were thoroughly examined in great detail, and we subsequently turned in a report which was called something like PPS, which is Project Proposal Sheet, Betty Wright knows. Later became PCS, Project Contracting. This became a report, incidentally, had a blue cover, and it was called Blue Book 25, some such thing. In any case, the conclusion of that study was, forget it. I want to make a comment about the monitors. All of the monitors that we got to know quite well felt that FTD looked upon the Blue Book project as a scant. It was in fact really wasted in their view of the project monitors, that they were never given the appropriate resource. Our experience was plenty of resources, there just wasn't a story to be told. The second kind of report we did came along several years later, and it had only one objective for Patel Project Stork FTD. Is there a threat to the national security of the United States? The answer was no. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to try and
answer. And George Fulton.
Well, you better take a drink of water, because what I have to say is,
pretty dry. To begin with, at that time, the FGD's intelligence department attracted a unique group of both military and civilian personnel. While they were not misfits or eight balls, they did march to their own drums. And sometimes without a drum. The first knowledge I had of flying saucers, or what later became flying saucers, was an officer by the name of Sniper, Bob Sniper. And I think at that time he was a major. And all the intelligence reports used to channel through to him, and then from there they were distributed out to some of the other people. And at that time, I think that he was slated to be he had a clearance above secret, so at that time, clearances meant a lot more than they do now. So all of these intelligence reports went to him first. And he had a group of them, I think at that time, George Gregory, he was healthy at that time, because Gregory, I think, was still in the uniform. And I originally started with FGD in June of 46, OT2. And my job at that time was to classify or categorize and identify foreign equipment being sent back to keep these ships that we had flying. And at about the only time I can talk about flying saucers is from the period of about September 47 through August of 48. Anything else after that, I have no knowledge of, just except hearsay. We were tasked by headquarters, who are real good at tasking, but very, very poor at funneling money back to us. And their job of doing that means work. So. Anyhow, we were tasked with it, and they set up a project, and Captain, or at that time, Lieutenant Howard Smith, a distinguished fighter pilot, and very good common sense, was assigned a project officer, and I was assigned to assist him. And we carried this through since we didn't have any money, we depended upon the OSI to run our investigations. We didn't have any money for travel expenses or anything, so we depended on the OSI to give us the information. The first thing we had to do was make a roadmap, where we wanted to go and how we were going to get there. To this end, we started to draw essential elements of information, which was an outline of the information we needed to try and identify these flying, well, what they call them, unidentified aerial phenomena. So to do that, we come up with a list of things we needed to know, and then the other thing was that we had to task different people to do that, because we didn't have the wherewithal of the knowledge, because most of it was celestial in nature, and at that time we brought in a contractor, which was Heining, Professor Heining from Ohio State, and we were lucky to get some money to do that. And the first flying saucer report was by a fellow by the name of Arnold. Kenneth Arnold out in Boise, Idaho. He was a civilian pilot, and in describing what he saw, he described it as kind of like a saucer. So that became the flying saucer. That's where the word flying saucer started. And after that report, they started to come in such numbers, and they actually increased quite a bit after the publicity. That, you know how news media does, they blew it up. And from then on, we started to get quite a few, and people started to ask questions. And one of the guys that was asking questions was the Saturday Evening Post, and we gave an interview to Sidney Shillette. And Sidney Shillette. then we really did it. We really did get a lot of reports. A lot of reports in. And most of them, we couldn't identify because there wasn't enough information. Some of them came in from overseas. We started studying this, and we found out there had been reports of unidentified flying objects way back to biblical times. Class in Fiery Wheel was one of them. Ezekiel saw that. And as we went on, we had to task other outfits. I think we even asked Project Rand to help us. We asked Patel to help us. We asked the Weather Bureau to help us. And we even sent stuff out to Sandia, which at that time was a research missile base, I think. And we kept getting reports and getting reports. And finally, since we weren't getting any answers to a lot of these questions that were raised by particularly the media, we decided to close down the report, close down the project, in which we did in, I think it was in August, I think, of 48. And this is a copy of our report, and our report was basically, if you got a minute here, we'll... There is no evidence that objects reported amongst are the result of an advanced scientific foreign development, and therefore they constitute no direct threat to the national security. In view of this, it is recommended that the investigation and study of the reports of unidentified flying objects be reduced in scope. Headquarters, AMC, will continue to investigate reports in which realistic technical applications are clearly indicated. And that's basically the conclusions and recommendations. Now, I also have heard lots of reports about the flying, the little man with stuff. And one of the things that I kind of recommend or recall was that at one time we got a bunch of classified equipment. In those days you couldn't talk about crypto equipment. We weren't quite ready to put it in use, so we looked around for a place to store it. And they offered us, the only place they offered us was a test cell for engine test cells over at Area C. And so we went ahead and put it in there, and naturally we put a guard on it. And as usually happens, everybody gets interested in what's happening when there's a guard on it. So I think one of our wagons told them, oh, that's a bunch of little red men, or little blue men, that we picked up and sent down and shot down the bus. I think that might just be the rage. Well, they agreed. Okay.
George Gregory never did write a book, yet he's one of the best writers I have ever seen. And you always have, during that period of time, you always have a lot of sightings when somebody was about to write a book. I think it started with Amazing Keyhole, who was a Marine Corps major. He wrote a book, and before the book was published, there were a tremendous amount of sightings. Some of our consultants at that time took the other side, because if you believe in flying saucers, you can sell a lot of books. And I don't know whether it was Dr. Heineck or maybe it was Sagan up in Cornell, but there were quite a few people at that time that were consultants. And they found out that writing objective reports on flying saucers was not the way to go. If you believed in them and wrote a book that you believed in them and saw them, you could sell a lot of books. Now, I don't know where George Gregory is now, but I'd sure like to get in touch with him. Thank you. Now, I'm going to get his address later on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, I'll go over here because I don't have my back to the panel. But I think I can make some remarks that are germane on this UFO subject. First of all, in the mid-40s, I was a B-29, B-50 flyer. And there were a few occasions where, on a radar, we picked up some really erratic movements, as in the film Stevens pointed out. On one of these occasions, I got on a radar scope, and we flew right through the darn thing, which meant that if the UFO had any turbulence, we'd have crashed, because we flew right through it. It undoubtedly was weather phenomenon, no question about it. But it's written up as an unidentified flying object. In 1941, I was at Northwestern University, and one of the courses I took was astronomy with Dr. Heineck, who was a very capable individual. When I came to Attic in 1960, I was with TDE, and I was the exec for the division, and all the UFO reports came through me, and I was very interested in the subject, as most people are, and we had Heineck as one of our investigators and so forth, and we sent him out with a team on all these investigations, some of you just absolutely can't prove. There was one guy up in Michigan who was literally a hermit. And a UFO came down his backyard, and they had breakfast and lunch together. And so our team went there, and this guy honestly believed it happened. So we investigated all the food that the UFOs had brought from interplanetary space and so forth. It was all stuff that's grown on Earth. I mean, we disproved it completely. But as far as he was concerned, you folks land in his backyard, you're never going to disprove it. So that's the kind of problems that you face when you're doing investigations. Now, as Vince just pointed out, UFOs are a big money item. Heineck, as long as he was with us, all the reports followed through me, so I knew exactly what he said, and I swear nothing was ever found of substance. Now, when we closed the project down, Heineck went on TV, he wrote books, he became a big talk guest, made all kinds of money. Now there is something, because he's making money out of it. The whole time he was with us, nothing. I swear, nothing. And as soon as he went, I got out of being a consultant for us, suddenly now there is all kinds of substance to the UFO subject, and he made all kinds of money. That's the kind of problems that you're facing in the UFO program.
Down on the pilot, what you're saying, I just saw the latest issue of Aviation Week and Space Technology, and they've uncovered through video, slow motion video, some kind of occurrence, meteorological occurrence, where there's these red sparkles and blasts of reddish light that occur over thunderstorms that they've never really captured before. So this meteorological phenomena, I think, hasn't been given enough credit in the popular press. What I'd like to do is, we have our last panel member here. I'd like to describe some of his instances. Maybe we can take one or two. two questions from the audience, but I'd like to have Lieutenant Jimmy Candrew describe some of his activity. I understand what you say. I want to go ahead and press on because we're right at our time here. It's most unfortunate, but I think what Jim McAndrew has to say, you'll find quite interesting and provides a nice cap on what we're doing. Jim?
Good morning. I'm Jim McAndrew from the Secretary of Staff. We conduct an investigation on behalf of the GAO. I think Lucy's observations were correct. Colonels still don't want this job. They still have it instead. And we conducted about 200,000 miles later, about a lot of manpower, a lot of lieutenants and full colonels running crazy around the Pentagon more than the usual now. And we came up with the same answer. What was that, Lucy? He said, bullshit. Conducted out of Alamo Gordo Army Airfield, just over the mountains from Roswell. It was a very compartmented project. It was very difficult to search these documents out, and I did it with the help of a very able Bruce Ashcroft. He gave a lot of knowledge we wouldn't have had, and we figured this thing out, and we put together a 750-page report, and a lot of people want it, but he comes up with the same answer Colonel Quicknell gave us about 30 or 40 years ago. Anyway, my name is front page New York Times, the other usual things like that.
We have time for that one question, and we'll have to
move on. Another question, comment. You get the impression that Project Blue Book over flying saucers were the most important element of their future at Maverick, was not. We put it to bed in the mid-50s with a conference, congressional committee, DOD committee, and now I hear we have another committee. And we continue putting the damn thing to bed, but there's always somebody who apparently must have a book in mind
money.
Who are rallying this thing up again. I want to make one recommendation is that at least this organization put the damn thing to bed and let's not hear any more about it.
Video.